Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. I'm glad to be here with you. For a brief stint, I head for Greece on Saturday, but I still have, I have podcast, as we say, in the can, and so I'll be able to send some of our most recent podcasts out while I'm gone, and I want to welcome everybody listening to the next chapter with Charlie. We're glad to have you, and as you know, this is a show where you can learn something about yourself that you just might be able to use to create the kind of life you want. Now, my special guest today is Devin Chatterton, who I am very excited to say is an attorney with the Immigrant Defenders Law Center, or known as MDEF, and we'll refer to it as MDEF. It's the Immigrant Defenders Law Center, and it is a next-generation social law firm focusing on immigration work in three major areas: children, adults with mental disorders, and universal representation. And all of this work is done pro bono. So today I want to jump right into the interview. So Devin, what's up?
Hi.
you ready to be interrogated? You ready to sit on the other side of the what do they call it? The Yeah, what do they call it when you're sitting in that thing? In England, they call it in the dock.
Oh.
In the dock, you know, when you're getting interrogated by an attorney. But before we start with MDEF, I wanted to remind our listeners that you were on the show, I think very early in the show, and you had just graduated law school at Georgetown, and you had just taken the bar exam, but had not as yet received the results. So since you're an attorney now, I assume you passed the exam.
Yes. Happy to report I passed.
And you passed it on the first go-round, right?
Yes, I did.
Isn't that kind of unusual? Isn't that a lower number of people that pass on the first go-round?
Yeah. I mean, I think the percentage that passed the summer that I took it was 43%. So I was one of the, 43% of California bar test takers that passed. So I was very delighted, to say the least, to find that out.
Yeah, so you didn't have to do any more study and go through that stuff again.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, Dev, how long ago was that? I can't even remember how long ago that was.
So that was in the summer of 2016.
So that's 2 years ago. That means my podcast has been going on for 2 years.
Yeah.
That's the only way that I can know, because you were, I think you were among the first 10 guests, because I look at my notes and they were really quite different. Do you think the same thing, that you were real early on the podcast?
I think I was. Yeah. I'm not exactly sure which episode, but early on.
Well, that's great. Now, the Immigrants Defenders Law Center was not your first job, was it?
That's true. Yes, it wasn't.
What did you do?
So when I first started, prior to getting bar results, I was working at the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. And there I was doing a fellowship in the Rackets Bureau. So I worked there for about...
In the Rackets Bureau? You mean like the mafia and the...
Yeah, I mean, I tried not to think about it so much, like The Sopranos, but very similar things, just a lot of money laundering, a lot of fake shell companies or businesses that were really used to do to either launder money or, just different criminal enterprises like that.
That had to be really fascinating.
Yeah, and a lot of what I was doing was drafting when you have a wiretap, you have to basically submit this huge wiretap application to the judge in order for the judge to okay that. So a lot of what I did was that and like search warrant applications.
So in that job, in that career, your job was to put people away. And
right.
And this job is to keep them out.
Yes, it is. Yes, it's the exact opposite.
Tell me, is after an experience on both sides of the aisle, is there one side you prefer, or is it you just like law?
So I think overall I do just like law, which is why it was so easy to switch from criminal law to immigration law. I just really have, and even law school itself, like it's a very, as I spoke before in the other podcast that I was on, or the other episode that I was on, but it's a very arduous process, but it's very enjoyable. Like learning different facets of the law was very enjoyable. So I haven't yet, even though now, I mean, I've been a lawyer for 2 years and I still am very up in the air as to like what area of law I will settle on. So it does start, I think, with my love of the law. But in addition to that, more specifically, whether it's prosecution or defense, I think the problem that I have with prosecution is this idea of prosecutorial discretion. And I think that's why I wanted to go into prosecution and why I wanted to do like criminal prosecution. It's because I thought, you know, along with the prison industrial complex and all these awful things about mass incarceration, I thought, you know, we're prosecuting really low level crimes. And by we, I mean the United States as a whole. It differs obviously between county and DA, but there's a lot of petty crimes that are being prosecuted and a lot of what seemed to me to be violent crimes that weren't being prosecuted enough, or people weren't getting sentenced accordingly. And so I wanted to go into that field and sort of see what I could do with the discretion that I had in saying, okay, you know, maybe we have this person who jumped the turnstile at the subway station, but I don't think that's worthy of my time or resources to put this person through a trial or to make them plea to a charge. But when you get into a position like that, you realize that this idea of prosecutorial discretion really is just that. It's an idea, and you have to sort of put in a good amount of time before, for lack of a better word, or for lack of a better word, what you say actually matters and what you think actually matters and holds a lot of weight. So once I found that to be the case, I was more leaning toward doing something along the defense side. And I wasn't sure whether I immediately wanted to go to criminal defense or if I want to do something else. And so I think now if I were to put my hat on prosecution or defense, I think I would go with defense. I think you have a little bit more autonomy, even in offices like the public defender. I think you have a little bit more autonomy with what sorts of things you do in your trial. And I think that's important. And I think that is those types of jobs are what I see myself doing.
Boy, I have two or three questions from okay. What you just said. First of all, prosecutorial discretion. Will you tell me what that is?
Yeah, so that just is this notion that as a prosecutor, you kind of have the discretion as to, okay, you know, the police officer arrested this person for this crime. However, now that we've looked at the facts, now that we've looked at the situation, we've talked to witnesses or whatever, this really isn't the best way to spend our resources, or this now isn't a crime that we think is as bad as it once was. For instance, possession of marijuana. You can now look back on those crimes and think, okay, is that really worth putting someone away and throwing them in jail over? And is it really worth taking it to trial and wasting our resources on that? So I think once you're able to make those types of decisions, like that's the discretion that I'm referring to.
Is it just one person has that the attorney that whose desk the paper lies on has a decision whether to try the case or not?
Yeah. So I think obviously that just depends on how, you know, each district attorney's office is run a little bit differently. But
sure.
So I interned at the San Francisco District Attorney's Office, and like I said, I was working at the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. And in both of those offices, it seems pretty clear cut, at least in big cities like those, where, especially when you're starting out, you kind of do, there's basic guidelines as to like, okay, if you get an arrest for this crime, or this crime, the lowest you can offer this person is X. Or like,
right.
The lowest you can plead
right.
down is X. So that becomes a little bit problematic in my mind, because I'm thinking, you know, going through hypotheticals like a law student, or and thinking, but what if we find this other thing, or what if we find these witnesses to not be credible, or what if
right, and would extend then the court case
something illegal?
Yeah.
So I would like to be in a position where I would have some sort of autonomy as to how to go forward, and it feels like, for the most part, from my experience specifically, that when you're a young attorney starting out in these positions, you really don't have a say. You kind of have to do what you're told.
Until you get your street cred.
Right.
Yeah. So there goes, with the way, the direction you're talking about heading in the public defender's office or the DA's office, the old myth about the attorney driving the Ferrari and living on the house on the hill is not is not in your future vision, is it?
No, unfortunately. Yeah, these positions that I am most leaning toward and find probably the most fulfilling just so happen to not be the ones with the really high salaries attached to them.
Have you always been a social justice kind of person? Or, you know, somebody that's interested in the socially... those on the lower scale are disregarded by, disenfranchised by society. Has that always been something with you, or is this something that has come to you via law school and experience?
I think a little bit of both. I think I definitely started out, you know, just as a kid being a very empathetic person and wanting to help people if I was able to. And also, you know, watching movies or reading books and just feeling really, really sad about certain people's misfortunes or situations, and, like, the really troubling feeling that comes along with that of, like, what can I do? How can I help? And I think that obviously has been increased by, you know, going to college in San Francisco, where people are very vocal and very outwardly...
Right.
They're very outward about how they feel about things. There's protests all the time, and there's talks all the time, and discussions all the time. So I think definitely going to college in a city like that, and then in addition to law school and finding out how, you know, certain, like, very grassroots movements have really changed a lot of policy in the United States, and I think that has impacted me as well.
Yeah, and, you know, and knowing you personally, knowing the way you were raised, although you were raised in Orange County, you weren't raised in Newport Beach with, you know, the people like your dad says that have those trees. And I ask him, he says, what are those trees? And he says, the ones that money grow on.
Yeah.
You know, you were in a diverse community, and so your history is with diverse people of all walks of life. So you have... your whole life, you've experienced people from different situations. I'm looking at my notes here as I'm going. You know, I have this question down, and it's, I'm going to take us off track, and then I'm going to put us back on track. But I want to take us off track just because I'm really curious. New York City, I find a really attractive city. I don't find it an attractive city to work in. But you know, there's so much going on in it. What was it like living in New York City? I mean, it's got to be one of the busiest places in the world.
Yeah. I think nothing can really prepare someone for living in New York City, and certainly living in other cities throughout the United States is a little bit of a start. So I did have, you know, because prior to that I lived in San Francisco, I lived in London for a little bit, and then I went to law school in D.C. So I wasn't so unfamiliar with city life, but New York is just such a different beast altogether.
Is it?
Oh my gosh. It's almost the first thing I felt when I got to New York, knowing that I wasn't coming home for a very long time, was just like claustrophobic. I felt very claustrophobic because it's such a blocked in city, and it's just, you know, Manhattan is just that little island.
But it's an island,
Yeah, but because there are so many large buildings looming over every corner, it feels like you're trapped in certain regards. And especially if you're moving there like I did in the middle of August when it's super humid and very hot, you definitely feel suffocated. So it's interesting getting used to something like that. And then from that, you kind of figure out how to, get yourself back to a safe space or what you think is like your norm. So for me, I like to run. And so my thing was running in Central Park because it's a very big park, and so you don't feel this like looming, these like looming buildings around every corner. You don't.
Yeah, and
really
it's
feel
a gorgeous park too.
Yes, yes. And in addition to that, my apartment was near the East River, and so I was able to run along the riverbank and then sort of follow the outline of the island of Manhattan and sort of do my runs like that and look at the water, and that obviously is like very pretty and way less constricting than running through the city.
Now, is everything true that the prices are crazy, the people are rude, and it's just a nutso place?
Kind of. I don't know if people are as rude as some would say, but for the most part, they're not sitting there taking your crap, basically, and they don't like the whole Southern hospitality thing. They don't like the whole like California chit chat thing. Like, they don't really care how your morning is going. But I think some of that is due to just the sheer amount of people that are there. And like, yeah. I very, very quickly adapted that attitude as well. And so I'm a very, what I would assume or what I would hope my friends would say is that I'm a relatively nice person. I would never snub people, walking along the street or anything like that. However, when you're in New York, because you're constantly weaving in and out of people, you tend to then get frustrated when people are just stopped randomly on the sidewalk or when people all of a sudden are looking at their phone and they don't know where they're going and they accidentally walk the wrong way. You're like, dude, what the heck? Like, get it together. But I think that is just a byproduct of how crowded it is in every single part of the city. But I would have to agree with what you said, that it's a very wild place. Like, the prices are very high. Rent is extremely high. And because that, you get very crafty and very... you get very unique ways of how to save money, or at least I did. And, it's pretty crazy. I think at one point, my parents came to visit and so did my brother. And it was one random Wednesday night. And he was like, I want to go out. I want to go to bars. And in any other city, I would have said, sorry, it's Wednesday. There's not going to be anything. It's 10 o'clock now. Like, we're done for the night. But because it's New York, I'm like, okay, what type of bar do you want to see? Like, what type of thing are you looking for? Because that's how many things are open right now and crowded with people.
No, what a crazy place. Well, yeah. Thanks for that. So let's get, now I want to get back on topic, but I just wanted to hear about that. So let's begin with just sort of an overall explanation of the nonprofit you work for, Immigrant Defenders Law Center, or called MDEF, and we may refer to it throughout the podcast as MDEF. What can you tell me about Immigrants Defenders Law Center?
Well, first of all, it's like a very young nonprofit. I think it was started just a few years ago, so that's not only in its like establishment and inception is young, but also the people are very young. A lot of the attorneys I work with are my age or maybe slightly older. Not a lot of people obviously have been there for very long, but a lot of people have been, a good amount of attorneys there have been practicing immigration for their entire career. So like, as you said in the beginning of the podcast, we have three basic projects that we work on. And so the first is the children's representation project. And then the second is the mental health, the adult with mental health issues project. So that's the one I work on. And then the last one is always, it's always evolving. It kind of just depends on the funding that we get. It depends on the cases that we get, but that's our universal representation project. So that's just basically, we will defend any immigrant in removal proceedings that we get, provided we have the funds to do so. So a lot of times the only way we turn down the client is because we don't have the funds to do so. But yeah, so with those three, obviously there are like paralegals and legal assistants for each of those groups. And
how many employees do you have?
Oof, I think around 50 or 60.
No kidding. So how many cases are you handling at one time? Not you personally, but the company.
Oh, I don't know. I think per year, at least for the adult cases, we do about 600 for the year. So, I mean, at any given time.
Oh, my
time,
goodness, 600. I mean, that is a tremendous amount. And yet, you know, the frustrating thing, it's like us with water in Uganda, and we're doing, you know, we've got 400,000 people that we have served with water, but we're just scratching the surface. The need is so humongous that we can't even, you know, we really can't even tap into the deep need, because there would need to be, you know, 2 dozen MDEFs in order to do that.
Yes, exactly. So
are all of your clients facing deportation?
Yes.
And so they are in some sort of holding facility right now? Or are some of them?
Some of them, yeah. So some of them are detained, and some of them have been released on bond. And that just depends on their past criminal convictions, how many times maybe previously they've been deported, removed, or deported, how likely they are to flee, things like that. But
sure.
Yeah, so some of them are out and living with family, but are on a bond. And so they still have to come to court, just not as frequently. And then the majority of my cases right now are detained.
Yes, because you're dealing with, why don't you explain your area of expertise or area of focus in the company?
Yeah, so I work, like I said, in the adults with like mental health issues. So they have all been served with the notice to appear saying, you know, you're either here without any status, or you're here with status, so you have a green card, or you came as a refugee or something like that, but because of a criminal act that you've committed, you're now, like, removable. We can now remove you from the United States because of something that you've done.
So have they all of your cases have committed some sort of criminal act?
For the most part. Sometimes they haven't, and they were just an arriving they just came to the border, and at the border they realized, oh, this person, you know, is obviously having hallucinations, or this person is obviously bipolar or something. And so then they will flag that as reason to have their competency evaluated. But for the most part, my clients have been convicted of some sort of criminal act, and that's what brings them to the attention of ICE.
And now, is that criminal act typically somehow related with their mental disorder?
Yeah. For the most part, it's really rare that I will have a client's like rap sheet and see something that isn't a result of some sort of mental health symptom that they have. And for the most part, for the majority of my clients, they're like the convictions that they have are related to drug use or drug possession. And a lot of times I will ask them, you know, why were you doing this drug, or why did you have these things on you? And they'll say something along the lines of, oh, well, because, you know, I feel really depressed sometimes, or because I feel so manic and high strung, I like doing X to make myself feel
sure.
better. Or because I hear voices or see things, if I do Y drug, it really helps me calm down, and it really helps me mellow out. It really helps me with whatever. And for some of them, you know, it maybe doesn't help them. And for some of them, it helped them at first, and now they're addicted, and now it doesn't help them. It's different. But a lot of times, like every single client I've talked to that has drug convictions attributes it to, I was hearing voices, or I was feeling this, and so that's why I turned to this person.
I want to continue with this conversation, but before I do, It's time for us to take a brief break. So if you just hang in there with me for 30 seconds or so, and we'll be right back. Hi, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie. I am speaking with an attorney, Devin Chatterton, who works for Immigrant Defenders Law Center, or MDEF. And Devin focuses on immigrants with mental disorders and tries to represent them in a court of law, and they typically, as we've been discussing, they typically have a criminal record due many times to drug abuse. And let's continue on with that. Devin, what types of mental disorders? I mean, you're describing some of the things when you said they're hallucinating. You're describing some serious mental disorders like schizophrenia and you know, well, that's the one that comes to my mind.
Right.
How can you even work out a case with them? Do you speak Spanish, Devin?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not as fluent as I would like to be, but that also has been increasing the longer I've had this job, because I'm practicing a lot more than I did in college or high school. It's an interesting sort of dance, so to speak, with people who have incompetency issues and trying to, you know, give them autonomy over their case, and also in certain situations maybe make your own assessment and move forward in the way that you think is best for their case.
How does the legal system, which I guess now are you doing jury trials, or is it just mostly with judges?
Yeah, so an immigration court, it's a federal court. They don't have juries, so it's all done in front of a judge. And because my clients, the project I work in, it's sort of enacted as a class action settlement agreement. And so in that settlement agreement, not only are attorneys provided for immigrants who have mental health issues that make them incompetent, but also it provides that the courtroom be sealed and that all their hearings be closed. So our trials that we conduct are basically just me, any witnesses that I want to bring forward, the client, and then the Department of Homeland Security's attorney, and then the judge.
Because that's who you're doing the case, who's representing the other side. It's not the DA, it's the Homeland Security.
Right.
And how do you find in these cases of mental disorder and drug abuse, I know this is a tough question, but how sympathetic do you find the judges to that? Do they feel like it's just a cop out and they're trying to get off with something, or are they sensitive to it?
I think so. In this instance, because the judge has to deem this person incompetent, so they already have to be on the lookout for, okay, this person in court obviously is saying things that don't make sense, or they're speaking at such a rapid pace that there's something else going on. So because it's already judicially initiated, I think the judges that do take on these cases are a little bit more sensitive to that. But sometimes there are situations in which certain disorders that make someone incompetent maybe don't mitigate all of their criminal actions, or the judge deems them not to mitigate all their criminal actions. And so obviously a judge is like a impartial body, but I think sometimes I think sometimes that does arise. I think their initial reaction of like, well, if this person isn't so visibly distraught or visibly mentally ill in court right now, then I don't really know how much weight to give to that.
Yeah.
But for the most part, in order to combat that, we have enough funding to secure our own, like, outside psychologists who go out to these detention facilities and they do their own evaluations. So usually once we submit that, those reports from that evaluation, I think the judge has a little bit more of a clear understanding of, like, maybe this client, for instance, is on great medication in this facility that's helping him a lot. However, when he was outside and he doesn't have the money to afford this medication, that's when his symptoms are way more visible than they are right now.
Well, you know, I just noticed you use the pronoun he. Is it is your caseload primarily male?
Oh, yeah. So I think some of my colleagues that work in the project, in the same project that I do, some of them have female clients, and I think I actually just got assigned my first female client. But for the most part, it is male clients.
And if you win a case, what happens to the immigrant?
So if we win a case, then they are released from detention. And then after that, they're able to get a work visa, depending on the status that they have. If they don't have a status, then they're able to apply for status. It's kind of a case-by-case basis. But especially for some of my clients that maybe are legal permanent residents, which is like a green card holder,
right,
they're now able to apply for full citizenship, which they usually do immediately, and then can sort of put this behind them.
So, I mean, I'm sure you have some people that are so mentally disabled that they are not capable of handling a job. Would that not be correct?
No, that's correct.
And so are they then put into some kind of facility, or are they just left to kind of figure it out?
So a lot of times we have like case management associates that will help us if this is a situation where someone's here, they don't have any family to take care of them, they don't have any reasonable means to make an income for themselves, then our case management associates will do a lot of research and speak to like residential psychiatric facilities or hospitals or even homeless shelters, anything like that. If it's like a homeless shelter coupled with an outpatient program that's across the street, things like that. So that's kind of when we will step in. But for luckily for a decent amount of our clients, they do have family here. And a lot of times their family are U.S. citizens, and so they don't have any hesitation of like helping them out or assisting with money or assisting with helping them apply to get government assistance, things like that.
That's great. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Do you say that overall, then? I'm getting a feeling that you're saying overall the system seems to be fair when it comes to immigrants and litigation, or do you see it leaning toward the other side more often?
Yeah, I would say no. It's for the most part not very fair. I think and that stems from a variety of things, one being like statutory immigration codes and things like that, but also case precedent, cases that the Attorney General is writing an opinion for, class action settlement agreements. Like I spoke before, there's a lot of different ways in which immigration law is governed. And so,
oh my goodness.
So I think as a whole, especially given how immigration law is it's a federal, it's done within the Department of Homeland Security, which is a federal agency. So because it is so dependent, or I guess rather because it stems so much from the current administration, that becomes a little bit problematic when that administration has problematic views of immigrants. So I think as a whole,
hugely,
right now, I would say no, it is not fair.
And you just rattled off a bunch of legalese that I think my listeners probably caught part of it. At least the degree, the complexity of each case, and it's almost as if you could, if you had the time, deal with three or four cases at a time and have your workload filled. But what is your caseload?
I think right now I have 16 cases, but I think you're probably right. There's not only a ton of legal research that you're doing, a ton of brief writing and filing motions and things like that, in addition to the fact that this is an area of law that changes so quickly depending on what cases have just been published. So you really have to stay on top of it. So I think you're right in saying that I could probably have easily a 9-to-5 with four clients.
Really? Really? So yeah. What is your day look like? It doesn't look like 9-to-5, right?
No. It tends to vary depending on what stage of the trial or of the case I'm in and how many clients are at that stage. So for a lot of the non-detained clients, the clients that are currently living with their family members, their cases go by a lot slower. So when you appear in court and you file something or you file their application for relief or anything like that, the next court date you're going to get is probably going to be 6 to 8 months down the road. So you have a lot of time to prepare in between.
Yeah, by that time you've got 70 cases to prepare for.
Right, exactly. So you have to shuffle that in addition to the detained cases where every 2 weeks I'm basically in court for those cases.
How has this job, Devin, impacted you personally with regard to two areas? One, with regard to your feelings toward immigrants, and also with your feeling toward mental disorders and criminality. So those are two totally different questions, but how has it impacted? Has it changed your mind about anything?
I think I already had a pretty progressive stance on immigrant rights and on just the sort of injustice that occurs when you don't give people a right to an attorney. I think a lot of people think, obviously these people wouldn't get an attorney because that's at our expense, that's not fair. But then it kind of boils down to this question of due process and whether if someone who doesn't have an attorney, who really doesn't understand, not only they don't understand English sometimes, they don't speak English at all, but when those words are translated from English to their native language, and if those words are motion to continue, administrative closure, notice to appear, stuff like that, that doesn't make sense. That still doesn't make sense to them. So I think before this job, I was very sympathetic to immigrants and to the struggle that they have not only to obtain legal status in this country, but then also to battle the stigma that comes along with not only, even if you're not here, and you're undocumented, even if you're documented, you still have the stigma of like, but you're not a real U.S. citizen. So
right.
I don't understand why you haven't become a U.S. citizen, or why are you still speaking Spanish? Why aren't you speaking English? So I think I was already very sympathetic to that plight, but now that I'm getting into the weeds of this legal system that really is just so, to me personally, I believe it to be so fundamentally unfair at certain parts of it. So I think that has changed to make me, I guess, even more progressive.
Right.
Or more enlightened in seeing how much this system really is kind of broken, for lack of a better word. And then I guess with regard to mental health, so I started college as a psychology major, but I think that lasted for like a semester before I switched to sociology. So I really didn't know all too much about mental health, especially the difference between, someone who has schizophrenia versus someone who's bipolar. And I was definitely using the term, oh, that person's crazy, that person's,
right.
It's stuff like that, where I wasn't really thinking about those things because I'm not really personally affected by these things. So it's hard. But I think this job has definitely made me see how dependent on, and sometimes it's circumstantial, sometimes it's these people, develop this mental illness as a product of their environment, but sometimes it is so luck of the draw, and it is so, sometimes it's genetic or what have you, but it's so sad to see someone struggle with that, and then also on top of that have to deal with this system that is really just against them from the very beginning.
Yeah.
It's really, really difficult to watch, and to have to interact with clients like that all the time. So I guess it's, I did have a lot of sympathetic feelings toward people with mental illness, people with criminal histories, people who, are here without status or are here trying to get, a legal permanent resident type of citizen, stuff like that. But I think, yeah, this job just really opened my eyes to see just exactly how much injustice there is and how it can't just be swept under this, that's really messed up.
Yeah, and no one really cares.
It's so much more specific than that.
You know, people don't seem to care because they're immigrants, so they're not U.S. citizens,
right.
And what rights do they have? And you've got all of those sorts of issues to deal with. And my listeners know that I belong to a 12-step group, and although it's largely based on alcohol, there's no one that drinks anymore that doesn't do drugs. Doesn't exist, especially heavy drinkers. And so we have a lot of times people who are truly not so much alcoholic, but addicts, they come to the AA meetings because they feel like they're getting better treatment there than they do in other 12-step programs. Mm-hmm. And it is amazing, Devin, the number of people that have psychological disorders that have led them to drugs and criminality, because then you've got to support your drug habit. But it was the mental illness that led them to drugs in the first place, because that was the only way they could feel. You know, people like to say they're trying to feel high, and I say they're not trying to feel high, they're trying to feel normal.
Right.
They're just trying to normalize. And so we have a lot of people that are on, antidepressives and anti-anxieties, serotonins and bipolar relief medications, that if they were not on that, they would be on substances. They have to, because they can't be normal. They have to have these medications.
Right.
And so I'm sure you face that so much.
Yeah.
My final question for you is, how has your personal work with immigrants impacted your life? Do you ever come across, I'll go political, do you ever come across the Trumpians that think you are just Satan for representing people like this?
Not personally, luckily. I don't think a lot of my friends hold that view. However, I know there was a bunch of people that I went to law school that definitely voted for Trump and definitely feel they just have a lot of hatred and a lot of, just judgment for this struggle that they a lot of times don't have any connection with and really don't understand all the issues. So that's a little bit frustrating. But as far as, not personally, but at least on, our organization, IMDEF, we get a lot of threatening calls or letters that are sent to us.
Threatening? What do you mean threatening?
Not insofar as anyone's, sending bomb threats or anything, but people are definitely you're going to hell, or this is the work of Satan, or,
Seriously.
Yeah.
You're trying to help people, human beings survive. And it's the work of Satan?
Yeah, and they'll send letters with, the swastika on it. And it just, and those types of things, they come from a deep, deep-seated hatred of the other. And so for that, I don't know that I can even judge their experience, because some of that is just so beyond reason. But I think it's even more frustrating to see some of that hatred come from classmates of mine or former classmates of mine, because you want to just say, like, I don't understand. It may be for those people because they're not studying these things, and maybe they're only reading propaganda and they don't understand what a valid news source is, or they don't understand what a legitimate study is, but you're smart. You're seemingly intelligent. So I don't understand why you're now subscribing to these, like, very bigoted ideals. It doesn't, like, that's what's harder for me to understand.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. Well, Devin, you know, since I've known you, since I think you were probably about 9 years old when we first met, because your brother played on my baseball team.
Yeah.
And, well, yours and your dad's in my baseball team. We both ran the team. And so I've known you for so long, it's easy, and I'm old enough to say, I'm so proud of you. You know, you have chosen a great career, and you've chosen such a caring aspect of this career that I'm just so proud to say I know you and watch you grow up and watch you be who you are, and now watch you helping society and helping people in society that don't have help. You're just, it's just great, Devin. You're really doing a great job.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, that's it for today. I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. Also, be sure to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life. That's L-I-F-E. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.